Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Jane Donahue. Today we take you to the University of New England in Biddeford, Maine for a debate between philosophy professors about the twin crises of perceived bias in college faculties and the decline of public trust in higher education. In this discussion, which was recorded before a live audience on April 6, philosophy professors Andrew Rotondo and John Waterman debate whether the ideological imbalance on college campuses merits an intervention, and if so, what that intervention should look like. Their conversation was moderated by University of New England's Associate Vice President of Communications, Sarah Delage. We begin with an introduction from University of New England President James Herbert.
I want to thank you for joining us for tonight's President's Forum conversation, in which we're going to explore how higher education became the epicenter of our national culture wars and what colleges and universities can do to rise above the politicization of our era and regain their previous stature as institutions treasured by Americans, regardless of their personal political beliefs. Those of us working in higher education were well aware of the reputational damage our sector has suffered in recent years. American colleges and universities, once revered as engines of opportunity, discovery, scientific advancement, humanistic and artistic innovation, and civic engagement, are no longer universally trusted and revered. Over the past year, tension on campuses has grown even more palpable. The arrival of the second Trump term has been accompanied by an array of federal decrees and policies aimed at exerting greater federal influence over the academy. These developments raise many questions. Is higher education really in need of reform in the first place? And if so, is it capable of reforming itself from within, or is strong governmental action the only way to get the job done? If reform is necessary, are the Trump administration's tactics justified? That is, are the administration's actions necessary to rebalance the academy and restore public trust, or are they just adding more fuel to an already raging culture war that has spread to practically every aspect of American life? And what does ideological balance even look like in the current political climate? These are among the many questions that we'll explore tonight. So without further ado, let's begin. Thank you. Sarah, take it away.
Thank you, James. I don't have much in the way of opening remarks. I figure it's best to just get to the questions. As President Herbert said, I'll take these guys through a moderated conversation, and then we're going to leave a few minutes at the end for some Q&A from the audience. We're going to spend the next hour or so discussing the Trump administration's unprecedented reforms of higher education, why they are happening, and what they mean for the future of American universities. But before we get into any of that, I want to ask you both a more basic question. We are accustomed to, as James pointed out in his remarks, political scientists and economists and journalists and political pundits having these conversations publicly. You are both professional philosophers. So what does philosophy bring that is maybe unique to the conversation?
So I just want to say thank you for the opportunity to be here. Sarah, the honest answer is that no philosopher has ever turned down an opportunity to tell people what they think. So I think that's maybe like the best, clearest answer. But I think if there's a better answer, it's because, the method of philosophy is the method of discussion. The method of philosophy is debate. The method of philosophy is to try and find something constructive out of disagreement, even when the topic is controversial. This is where philosophy began, asking hard questions. And this is a topic about which people are having difficulty discussing, right? Politics in the classroom. And if there's a reason why philosophy might have something to say about it, it's just because that is what we do.
Andrew, would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess I'd also add that philosophers have been interested in education since the beginning. You know, you go back to Socrates and Plato and Aristotle in the West and Confucius in the East, you know, as a central part of what they were up to is how to transmit wisdom and how to, you know, educate the next generation. So philosophers have been talking about these things for a long time.
Great. It's a good segue into the real meat of the conversation. So the Trump administration has argued that American higher education was in need of serious reform, pointing to things like a national six-year undergraduate graduation rate of just 64%, nearly a quarter of bachelor's degrees offering a negative return on investment, and what it described as ideological capture of academic culture and accrediting bodies through things like DEI mandates and affirmative action. At the same time, critics argue that federal research funding through agencies like NIH and NSF has been the backbone of American innovation in medicine, energy, and technology, and that dismantling DEI frameworks removes protections for vulnerable students rather than fixing institutional failures. And these are just a couple of examples. So the question for both of you is, was there a genuine crisis in American higher education that justified an unprecedented federal intervention of this scale, or were these reforms essentially a solution in search of a problem?
Yeah, I'll go first. So, yes, I think that I'm going to argue that the situation in higher education warrants an unprecedented intervention. So the intellectual climate of academia and the policies of academia, you know, the DEI policies, the race-based hiring and admissions policies, the content in the journals, the curricula, they overwhelmingly promote a set of moral and political ideas that are ones that, frankly, somewhere around 50% of the general population in the country reject. At the same time, universities receive tremendous support in the form of federally backed student loans, federal grants, and a place in an economy where the product, so to speak, the college degree, is effectively become the admissions ticket to a career in middle class life. Academia also has enormous cultural influence, right? It shapes our leaders and business, law, finance, education, the arts, and of course our intellectuals. And this, despite this being the case, the political views of academia, again, don't represent the political diversity of the country. Rather, they are a kind of narrow and relatively homogenous politics. So critics have pointed this out for decades, and academia has effectively done almost nothing to address this. In fact, the problem has gotten worse over time. So I would say at this point, yes, some sort of intervention is justified.
John?
So I think this is an important topic, but if I can recommend something to people to read, like I like to assign homework.
Should have known that was going to happen.
I would like to recommend to everyone George Orwell's The Politics and the English Language. This is an insightful essay, and what it tells us to do is to attend to language. What we are hearing is the language of reform. And if we want to see the language of the current presidential administration, you can see it in this April 2025 demand letter that was sent to Harvard, sort of outlining its critique of the academy. And there you see the language of ideological capture. You see the language of egregious bias. And this is the language of the pursuit of truth, right? It frames what's going on as something that is about the pursuit of truth. And if you are concerned about the pursuit of truth, then like the remedy is clear. It is conversations like this, right? It is discussion. If you want to seek the truth, if you want to understand, right, how to see the world fairly, it is through discussion. But what Orwell points out in Politics and the English Language is you have to distinguish the literal meaning that institutions of power, right, the words that they say, from their actions. And although their language is about the pursuit of truth, what you see in that letter are demands and coercion. You see a demand for a penalty payment. You see the discussion of never-ending compliance review. you see the language of revoking nonprofit status and revoking scientific funding. That is about applying power, right, to change how an institution behaves. It's not about the pursuit of truth anymore. It is about it is about the most powerful institution in our lives trying to exert its influence over an institution that seeks the truth. If you want to have a discussion, have a discussion. But if you want to coerce people, you use these kinds of mechanisms.
Andrew, you have a response to that?
Yeah. So I tend to agree with a lot of what John is saying. I think that there has been you could classify it as a kind of bait and switch about what's happening in higher education for a long time, you know, the right wing or conservatives. And by the way, I think we'll kind of use that terminology. I mean, I'm not going to try to make subtle distinctions between what is left wing and right wing exactly. Seems like it'd take us too far afield. So, you know, I might say right wing or left wing or conservatives and progressives and kind of, you know, using those synonymously. So for conservatives for a long time have complained that they just want to be able to express their ideas in higher education. They just want the freedom. And a lot of the language is still like that. But a lot of what is happening at the federal level and in the states is actually sort of coerced ideology, like forcing universities to either proclaim certain kinds of views or, prohibit them from defending certain kinds of views. That is what's happening. I think that's partly what you're talking about. There is more to the story. I mean, I think the other side of the story from the right-wing perspective would probably be that universities have been doing this themselves for decades. They don't use the force of the law or regulations, but there's ways that they have of kind of, you know, policing the boundaries of the discourse and making sure that only certain ideas, you know, like a certain range of ideas are heard. So one way of looking at this is just this is the right wing, you know, fighting fire with fire. I'm going to argue tonight for a kind of view that is not doing this, but is to allow genuine open inquiry at the university. This raises a deep kind of question about what the role of the university is. Is the university a place where we're transmitting a particular set of values and political views in a fairly rigid way, or is it a place where the goal is open inquiry with the pursuit of in the pursuit of truth? And I want to argue for the latter. You know, maybe the person who gives us the best tools to defend this is John Stuart Mill, famous philosopher John Stuart Mill, who 150 years ago wrote a book called On Liberty, where he gave an extremely powerful defense of the idea that if we really want the truth, we need to hear everything that can be said about an issue from all sides. And one of the most compelling arguments Mill gives, I think, is when he says, when we're talking about complex social moral issues, it's rare that one side has the complete truth. He says, usually all sides have something, you know, a partial truth, an insight, a grain of truth. And if we really are seeking the truth, what we need to do is, you know, listen to them, try to understand them charitably and collect those insights, collect those grains, collate them, and then form a more complete picture of reality. So I think the university is a place as an inspiration and ideal. We can seek to be a place where we have genuine open inquiry in the pursuit of the truth. I think it's a noble mission. And I think we need a little outside help to get that going right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is where we have common grounds about like the function of the university as an institution that aims towards seeking the truth. And when I think about the challenge that is being directed at, you know, university and university culture from the right, it is about sort of a demand to have a voice included, right? And when I think about this, it just reminds me that the role of the academy has been debated, you know, for many generations. This is not the first time that we have like discussed, like, what is the role of the academy? What is the role of what we teach? You know, a generation ago, a similar kind of debate was made, was developed around the role of the university, and it was a debate about diversifying the faculty and diversifying the curriculum and broadening what we study, because a narrow-minded curriculum produces narrow-minded thoughts. And I think the most powerful version of the conservative critique of the academy right now is that there are these voices and these voices are missing, right? If it was right to diversify the faculty a generation ago, if it was right to broaden what we study a generation ago, shouldn't we seek to have like a broad set of ideas and values represented in the faculty? And so I do think that there's something right in that critique. There are some voices that are missing, right? The faculty does tend to lean left and look left. I mean, I think that that's right and true. But where I disagree is about the proposed remedy, right? If you look at some thinkers on the right now, like Max Eden is a conservative intellectual at the Heritage Foundation. And the way he describes it is that every classroom is ideological. And I just don't think that that's the case. I don't think that every classroom is ideological. And what is being called for on the right now is for, and this is a vague phrase, but it is a critical mass of viewpoint diverse faculty. And again, if we look at this demand letter that was sent to Harvard last spring, what it demands is a critical mass of viewpoint diverse faculty in every department and in every unit. And I'm not sure what a critical mass means. I'm not sure if it necessarily means a majority. But we study a lot in a university. We study ornithology. We study art. We study genetics. And I think there's this tremendous overreach to think that you need some critical mass of conservative thinkers offering an opinion about every one of these topics. I think that you could diversify the faculty to some degree, but I don't think that every classroom is a mini presidential election. That's just not what it is. But it's being treated that way and it's being portrayed that way. And so we see that the remedy has to be some kind of balance, political balance. But right and left are not the only forms of diversity in inquiry. And so I think what is being demanded is far in excess of what is necessary to create like a rich and vibrant and honest discussion of what matters.
So, John, it sounds like you're acknowledging this is a problem, right? Or that this exists, this underrepresentation of conservative faculty, but the remedy is what you kind of disagree with. I'm curious, Andrew, what your thoughts are on that.
I think it's primarily an issue in certain fields where the subject matter is directly connected to the kind of moral and political issues we're talking about. So the arts, humanities, and the social sciences would really be the places where that would come up. So, yeah, I mean, I think that would be the place to start. I'm not so sure. I mean, you know, there's debates to be had about some of the physical sciences too, but I'm just thinking of the fields that I mentioned.
Any response to that, John?
Well, I think it's right to reckon with the fact that there is an absence of some perspectives in the faculty. I mean, I think that's true. And I think we can ask a question about like why those views are not represented. I think the proposal that you hear on the right very frequently is that these views are discriminated against or that they're not welcome. And I'm not sure that that is the case. I think that right now we live in a generation where many people are selecting out of the academy or selecting out of education, and we see them not choosing to enter into the academy. And that is a far more likely explanation that there is some kind of hostile culture to conservative thought.
So, yeah, I think it's an interesting question why more conservatives are not in academia. And some of the things that I think are relevant in answering that question are, I'll mention maybe three areas of why they don't come, and then maybe we could talk about the general mindset. There are some studies that indicate that there is just outright discrimination against conservatives in academia. So this is not, my comments here aren't meant to impugn you know, progressives as being especially discriminatory. The evidence suggests actually that everybody does this to some extent, right wing and left wing. But the problem is that right now the proportionality in academia is heavily skewed to the left. There's different measures on this, but it's very uncontroversial. You know, it's, I don't know, you know, 5-1, 10-1, some, you know, some disciplines more than that. And because of that, and because there is discrimination, you have this ratcheting up effect where as the process goes on, there are fewer and fewer conservatives in the system. So let me give you a concrete example to say. So this research shows that somewhere around 30-40% of academics will admit in anonymous surveys that they would be inclined to discriminate against, you know, somebody with different politics. So at UNE, in my school unit, when we see faculty searches, there are typically three people on that committee, right? Now, if these numbers apply to UNE in general, that means that most of the time, probably I kind of like worked out the math a little bit on this, somewhere around 70% of the committees, you would expect to have at least one discriminator. And that's huge. That can make all the difference. Then what will happen over time is that there will be fewer conservatives who make it through the screening process, and then the cumulative effects of the discrimination increase. And in fact, this pattern, and we don't know if it's exactly discrimination, but this pattern of there being fewer and fewer conservatives in academia is what we've seen over the last several decades. So I don't think we should, you know, discount that as a problem. The second problem is the perceived hostility. So, you know, on surveys, conservatives, would-be conservative academics, say they perceive academia to be a place that's pretty hostile to their ideas. You know, they're intelligent people who read the news. They see the speaker disinvitations, the people getting shouted down, the, you know, social media outrage mobs. They see this, and they get the sense that they're not really welcome there. And then the third thing is that it's kind of a pathway issue. There's a kind of infrastructure in academia. You need, and this is like the critical mass thing, I think what they're getting at. You need a bunch of faculty members who are working on a set of issues. You know, the journals are talking about those issues and the presses, people to mentor graduate students. And if you don't have that, there's no structure for you to kind of glom onto. So undergraduates who might be interested, like they don't see these topics being discussed in the journals. They don't see their professor mentors talking about these things or expressing interest in, you know, supervising research projects in them. So they don't see a place for themselves in academia. So that's the kind of third. So I think all three of those things are relevant factors and seem to be what's going on.
I mean, so I think this is an interesting point because I think that serious conservative political thought has moved out of the academy and it lives in some institutes like Heritage and Claremont, and it has migrated away from the academy. But I actually think that this raises a really sort of like deep and challenging political or philosophical question about the nature of conservative political thought. Okay. But to understand it, I think we need to like talk about like what a liberal education is and what a liberal education aims for. I mean, what we do here is liberal education, and it's not like liberal, progressive, and conservative, Republican. It is an education that aims to free one's mind. And, you know, that does not come easily, and to have a free intellect is not automatic. It is something that has to be cultivated. So we are we're reading Mary Wollstonecraft in one of my classes right now. And she argues forcefully in the Vindication of the Rights of Women that it is necessary for all men and all women, if they are to be free, if they are to have like control over themselves, if they are going to control their destiny, they need an education, right? That doesn't come automatically. And the reason why you need an education to be free is you have to learn how to question the ideas that can come to control you. And, you know, we are sort of hungry norm adopters as children. We want to believe the people around us. We want to believe our parents. I'm scared of how much my children just want to believe what I believe. I have young kids, and they just want to believe what I want to believe. And I want to turn them into little philosophers. And it's hard because they just want to know, what do I believe? And then they want to believe it too. We are hungry belief adopters when we're young. But notice, when you do that, you are kind of captured by those ideas. Those ideas rule you. They are in charge of you. They shape your decisions. And if you are never exposed to something different, if you're never exposed to some alternative, if you never see the diversity of views that are out there, then you are controlled by these early ideas. And what a liberal education aims to do is it aims to free you from that by challenging you to challenge your own core beliefs. Like, that is what we are trying to do. We are trying to equip students to challenge their own core beliefs, not to change their mind necessarily, but often to just strengthen it, because they will understand themselves better if they can do that. And here's where I think there could be a kind of profound tension between the aims of a liberal education and the core insight of conservative political thought. And the basic insight of conservative political thought comes from Edmund Burke. And Burke argues in his Reflections on the Revolution in France, as he watched, you know, the Enlightenment test itself in this revolution and see the Enlightenment ideal of reason disintegrate into chaos and terror and death and destruction. And he thought, there is a wisdom in tradition. You cannot throw traditions out lightly. Learning how to live together is hard. These solutions are discovered slowly, generation by generation, and they are accumulated in traditions. And when you try and revise all of society, you're inevitably going to do worse than this. But these ideas are in tension. If the conservative, like the core of conservative political thought is that you have to preserve tradition, you have to conserve tradition, right? You have to pass it on. And I understand that that's valuable. It makes it very hard to also question it. And I have a sense that right now, people who see the virtues in this form of political thought are selecting out of the academy because they are uncomfortable with the freedom of thought that you have to offer to students as they examine all these different points of view. I don't think that they are being selected against. I think that they are selecting out.
Well, let me ask this question then. Regardless of why there are so few conservatives in academia, given that it seems like we can all agree there are so few, what do you think about this concern that the left wing is indoctrinating students on college campuses? Is that a legitimate concern?
Yeah, can I just respond to what John
sure.
said just go, for, just
go
for
it.
A second?
Go
yeah.
for
no, sorry. It's a fascinating topic, and maybe this is, you know, the deeper philosophical discussion that we're so. This idea that conservatives kind of don't have the mindset to engage in academia and higher education, I think that it's somewhat of a misconstrual. Unless we assume something about what is legitimate higher education and the life of contemplation and inquiry, I think John's absolutely right. There's a difference in mindset of conservatives and progressives. And I would put it in something like there's a default mode of conservatives to kind of trust in tradition and the way things are, and a very high threshold for challenges to that to, you know, be enough that we throw out the way it's been done. And on the other side, I say there's more of a default to be skeptical of tradition and to be welcoming to challenges. But there's a way that There's a way of doing open inquiry that both sides can engage in. It's to consider arguments. It's always to consider them and try to learn from them and understand them and deepen your thought and appreciation of, if you're conservative, you know, what you're doing is you're trying to deepen your appreciation for the things that you love and want to hold on to. And if there's challenges, that can teach you something about, you know, why would people not understand that? What are they missing? Sometimes you do need to reform a little bit, but there's more of a default again to keep things in place. Whereas on the other side, again, what you're learning is more, you know, how do we reform things? What does a better, more ideal society look like than the one we have? So I think that both are, you know, I'm not convinced, at least, that you know this explains why they're not there. So
as a philosopher, I want to dig into the details of Andrew's sort of response.
Not too many details.
Right. Yeah, I know. So what I'm going to do is resist, actually. And I do want to take up the question and the topic that you raise, Sarah, because I think that this is a worry out there, right? That what are liberal professors doing? They are indoctrinating their students, right? There's a single perspective, and what do? We just try and replicate that in our students. And then why on earth should we pay a lot of money to have this done? I think that's where a lot of the mistrust comes from. So I want to share some work that I do. So I'm an empirical philosopher. I gather data. And so this is one of the questions that I ask my students. Do you think it would be, so you gotta pick a topic, like a topic about politics or a moral topic. You gotta fix that in your mind. Do you think it would be okay for me to try my hardest to try and change your mind about that topic? Like in front of the classroom, do you think it would be okay for me to do that? Right. And I mean, we can all guess, but a very large majority of my students think that that would not be okay, right? They are not interested in the idea that I'm going to try and change their mind and try and change them to believe something different. Okay? But then this is where I think it gets interesting. Now I ask my students, do you think that I could if I tried my hardest, right? Do you think if I use all my powers of persuasion and I name some theories and I talk about who we've read, do you think you have some sincere moral political belief and I can change your mind? And the answer is no, right? They don't like the idea of classroom advocacy, but they also don't think that I'm going to change their mind. And that makes me question, like, what is the danger? I think that the real worry, the real problem of indoctrination is not that the faculty are going to do it. There are psychologists who have studied this, and it just turns out to be really, really hard to change people's minds. I think the real problem is that by raising the worry, faculty now are so worried about appearing biased that they pull their punches, that they present every issue as having some kind of ersatz balance to it. And as long as there is something you can say on behalf of your view, then that's enough. And I think that by sort of like conceding this, by worrying too much about indoctrination, we're actually not forcing our students to confront that some of their beliefs might be shallow. They actually haven't worked out why they should hold them. And I think you would recognize that actually in an environment where it was okay to challenge your beliefs. I think it is important to get into arguments and then to lose them. And that doesn't mean you have to change your mind. It just means that you have to do more and understand where your beliefs are coming from. And I think we do that less now because we are so worried about looking biased that we don't challenge our students to think as hard as they can. And I think that that's the real worry of indoctrination.
Andrew, I'd love your thoughts on that as well.
Yeah, that's fascinating, John. I agree with a lot of what you said. And, you know, just a couple thoughts to add to what you're saying in agreement. I think of William James, the famous American philosopher. He had this, he compared our ideas to electrical wires in one famous piece he wrote. And he said, you know, some ideas are live to us and some ideas are dead. You know, they don't capture your intellectual imagination if they're not live. They're just things that you can't conceive, but other just reach out to you. And I think that's true of us. And we should, you know, that should inform our teaching and our scholarship. It does. And it seems psychologically unrealistic and even inhuman to expect us all to be perfectly neutral or perfectly balanced in our teaching and our scholarship. I don't think we can really do that. So this ties into my previous point, though. I think what's important is political balance kind of across the faculty rather than within each individual faculty member. And the point that I do want to disagree with you about, though, is that universities aren't indoctrinating. I think you're right. And maybe I thought you were going to share your cartoon ideas.
Okay, so Andrew is inviting me to recruit somebody to help me out. I have a lifelong ambition to get a cartoon into the New Yorker. But everyone I know who can draw doesn't think I'm funny. And everybody who thinks I'm funny can't draw. And so I've never got it. Okay.
Surely, but maybe there must be a solution to this problem.
Yeah, so there's somebody out here who can help me. Okay, so here's my New Yorker cartoon. It's going to be a professor standing at the board. There's going to be a picture of Marx in there or something like that. And they're going to be very passionately pointing at that. And then the caption is going to be liberal professor indoctrinating their students. But then the classroom is all going to be looking at their smartphones, right? And I feel like this will get in. No one I know will draw it for me. But I think you're just helping that we are just one voice among many, and they have many sort of intellectual outlets and many places where ideas can come from. We have this one role where we can challenge them and push them hard, and we're retreating from it.
Yeah, no, I agree on that. I agree, but I don't think that the indoctrination comes from proselytizing our students, which as you illustrated there, it's not that effective. It's indoctrination through absence. It's because people come to the university system and they don't get exposure to a rich and sophisticated set of ideas that are important. I ultimately think that there's a kind of yin and yang between these positions that is important. And these are our future leaders in business, finance, education, the law, the government, right? And so if things get one-sided, history teaches us, it's replete with examples of, you know, civilizations going off the rails. I think of I think of the social psychologist Jonathan Haidt, who reports in one of his books that, you know, he'd gone through graduate school. He was teaching for, I think, something like a decade. And he was curious about, you know, one of the aftermaths of the political, the presidential election, I think, in 2004. And he was curious, and he went to a bookstore and he picked up a book on conservative thought and he started reading it. And as he reports in the book, he said he was literally floored. He had to sit down on the floor because he had never been exposed to this. And he thought a lot of it was very sensible and in line with the work that he'd been doing in social psychology, and it offered important, rich insights into, you know, human societies and how they cooperate and how they form communities. So our students need to see that, and, you know, their lives and our society will be impoverished if they don't.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's talk was recorded live at the University of New England on April 6th. Stay with us as UNE philosophy professors John Waterman and Andrew Rotondo share their thoughts on the Trump administration's attacks on higher education.
I'm going to turn back now to the Trump administration reforms to get your thoughts on another aspect of that. So even those who agree reform was needed may disagree sharply with how it's been achieved. And we can consider the range of tools the administration has used. An unprecedented number and scope of executive orders, dismantling the Department of Education and redistributing its functions across other agencies, ending affirmative action in admissions and hiring through civil rights enforcement rather than legislation, freezing billions in research funding at places like Harvard, Columbia, and Northwestern to force sweeping governance and policy changes, eliminating or vastly reducing student financial aid, directing what can and cannot be taught or researched on campus by threatening the funding that makes that work possible, and working in parallel at the state level to implement similar changes where federal authority has met legal resistance. So supporters say universities have lost their way and have become leftist ideological monocultures incapable of reforming themselves, and only serious pressure will produce the accountability and change needed to restore public trust in higher education. Critics say these tactics amount to dangerous government coercion of independent institutions, threats to the academic freedom that make American universities the envy of the world. So, regardless of whether the goals were legitimate, were these tactics, taken together, a justified exercise of federal authority, or do they represent something seriously troubling and dangerous about the relationship between government power and institutional independence? I'll let either one of you take that.
So I'm happy to start with that. And I think some broader context is really useful for, again, understanding these tactics. We've just talked about all the different ways in which this institution, really the most powerful institution in our life is exerting its power on the academy. But we are not the only place where we're seeing that power exerted, right? We've seen it exerted on journalists as well. We've seen journalists denied their press credentials. We've seen them denied their ability to cover the White House and the Pentagon, okay? We have not just seen journalists denied their ability to cover these things. We've seen them sued. We've seen the legal system weaponized to try and silence them. And it's not just journalism and the academy. We've also seen this in law, right? We've seen law firms deny the ability to represent people in federal court. And then finally, we've seen it in the sciences, where funding has been withdrawn from projects that are deemed ideologically problematic. And if you look at these institutions, the academy, journalism, science, law, what do they have in common? They have in common at their heart this ethic, which is that the pursuit of truth matters. The truth matters. The getting things right matter. And what you see, the attack on the academy is part of this larger attempt, right, to control what we believe. And I mean, here's the thought experiment. I mean, you can imagine a country that has, a functioning democratic electoral system, but the only source of information is the government. Is that a healthy democracy? I just think the answer is obviously no, but that is what we are seeing. This is a piece of a much larger attempt to control information, and it's something that we should see as like deeply, deeply problematic.
Andrew, your thoughts?
Yeah, so, the government is one mechanism to control thought. So is the media, so is academia. And the response to this, I think the right-wing response to this would obviously be like, well, those institutions have been narrowing and controlling and, limiting the thought in various ways for a long time. And I'm not here to speak about in particular the media or these other things. So they're interesting, fascinating topics. But, when you look at the academy and what's been going on there, to invoke Mill, he talks about the idea of a social tyranny being just as formidable as government tyranny. In fact, perhaps even more insidious because it's less easy to detect. It's more subtle and it weaves its way into more areas of our lives. The last 10 years, 15 years in academia, we've seen just a lot of chaos. We've seen speakers disinvited, shouted down, even physically attacked. There's been all kinds of faculty open letters getting signed that function as kind of just outrage mobs. Publications have been rescinded. People have gotten accepted into journals and even books and then had their articles or books, pulled from the publisher afterwards. It's unprecedented kind of, censorship of ideas, frankly. Professional retaliation, professors getting disciplined or fired, people being canceled. I mean, I just want to take a note. Nobody's ever said this in public before. It's like the term being canceled is just such a sick, dehumanizing term, as though a human being can be, quote, canceled. And that was sort of nonchalantly normalized over the last 15 years. So I think that, again, I support the university being a place of open inquiry. And I'm not here to defend the particular policies of, the Trump administration. But I don't understand why, if there's not going to be a fair and honest attempt to do that, that, say, the political right wing wouldn't use its, its levers of control to kind of force its to do what it perceives, the political left has been having done for a long time.
I guess that's, I think, where we differ a little bit. I mean, I think that if the truth is what's in question, then the solution is, again, discussion and debate. It is not to pull the levers of control, right? The government has incredibly powerful mechanisms of coercive force that it can use against citizens, against institutions. And when you see those levers being pulled, you should be incredibly wary. I guess there's something we haven't talked about a little bit, but I'd be remiss if we didn't talk about it, okay? Like, some of the forms of inquiry that, like, this administration is determined to stamp out is this this idea of, like, diversity, equity, and inclusion, that it is that these things should not be studied. And again, if you look in this April demand letter where the administration sort of lays out its you know, critique of the academy, one of the demands that it makes is a stop to all DEI policy and an end to all DEI instruction. But let's look at what we are being asked to stop doing, words we have become afraid of, right? And I have witnessed the fear of these words as they were stripped out of departments and taken out of curriculum, and worried that the appearance of any of the words diversity, equity, or inclusion could mean that we lose funding at this institution. But when we study diversity and equity and inclusion, what do we study? We are studying the ways in which the powerless have been exploited. We are studying the ways in which, right, non-Western countries have been exploited. We're looking at how people have been exploited based on their race or their gender. That is what we are studying. We are studying the ways in which power has used its power to control people. That's what we're looking at. And now, all of a sudden, what should we not do? We should not study the ways in which the powerful have exploited the powerless. And that is what's trying to be silenced here. And if you want to understand how power operates, if you want to understand how power uses its power to stay in power, you want to understand how people are exploited, how labor is exploited, how women are exploited, how people are exploited, right, for all manner of purpose, you have to look at how that power is used. And that studying those topics is how we understand it. And it is deeply ironic that getting rid of these ideas is clothed in language of free inquiry. It's anything but.
Andrew?
Yeah, again, I don't exactly disagree with you. Again, I think that there is coerced ideology coming from the right now in academia. And I think that I would support all those things that you mentioned being studied. They're important topics, and we can learn from studying and thinking about those things. But there's a whole other set of views that are not really allowed to be considered or taken seriously in academia. You know, surveys show that somewhere around 82% of Americans think that race should not be a factor in admissions in higher education. 82%. Even among Black Americans, it's like 54% or something like that are against it being used. 34% of Americans think that racial discrimination now applies. White Americans think that racial discrimination now is being used against them. But if you're in academia and you suggest these things and you want to talk seriously about them, good luck. And you want to talk about fear and intimidation. Let me ask you a question, John. Do you feel afraid up here now defending this idea? Because I feel a little uncomfortable saying this in front of you. I feel very uncomfortable. Why is that?
So I think why I was so interested in having this conversation with you is because I actually know Andrew to be intellectually fearless and to be willing to explore ideas and to explore them so we can understand them better. And your point is well taken, actually, that I have the easy side of this discussion. I think I feel comfortable in the crowd, and it is hard to examine ideas from every perspective. So I think the point is incredibly well taken. But where I think I disagree, okay, is again in scale and scope. I think that in many ways, right, these powers have found ways to divide people that have a lot in common. And Charles Mills is a political philosopher, and he thinks that there should be a lot of solidarity between, right, the majority of Americans, but yet, like, questions of identity have somehow been, like, weaponized as wedge issues to divide people when we all have more in common than we don't, So, I mean, I just want to concede the point, but at the same time, I don't think that like free inquiry can be achieved by using the levers of coercion and of power. It's not how you change minds. It's just how you force people to do things.
Andrew, anything to add on that point?
I mean, I'll just reiterate again. I would like there to be open discussion about everything. I would like all sides to get a hearing.
So I have to point out that Andrew just won the debate because a philosopher conceded even something small to another philosopher, right? That's total victory in philosophy, actually.
Well, then I have one final question for you both before we open it up to audience questions. And I think this will be a good note to end on. What to do moving forward about the political situation in higher education? You know, how can we, even on a smaller scale or perhaps on a larger scale, improve the situation and maybe try to move the needle on restoring trust in colleges and universities in the United States? No pressure.
Yeah, I mean, so that's a big question. And having had a conversation about politics, like I loathe to bring up AI for a second too, and just make us really worried
now
about our future.
You're the unpopular one in the room.
But I think what we do is more relevant than ever. And you want to convince people about like the value of a college education, a liberal education, what we do here. I mean, what we do here is study human ideas in the greatest depth possible. I mean, we learn what it is possible to be as a human being by studying what we study. And that is like more unique and more valuable than ever as these machines become like a bigger and bigger part of our lives. We become more valuable, more important, right? The better we understand ourselves. And I'll just say that again, right? We become more valuable and better the better we understand ourselves. And that's what we do in a liberal education. And you want to, you know, recover the public's trust, just remind them that that is what we're doing here.
Andrew? Yeah, it's a big issue, like you said. And when it comes to, since this is about politics, the debate tonight, I would say that, you know, there's an opportunity for the academy to be a place that's welcoming to a demographic of people that have been felt unwelcome for a while in the academy and have more open discussions about these things that are conducted without fear. And I think, you know, we should aim to do that. I mean, frankly, the academy is becoming a little bit politically irrelevant. I mean, not just a little bit. I mean, most of the more interesting debates are happening in, you know, podcasts and on social media. And we shouldn't, that's fine, but there's a place for them to happen with the kind of rigor and carefulness of the academy. And we should want that. I think that would be good for the society, good for our students' minds. And, you know, probably good for the bottom line of universities, frankly. So, you know, there's ways we could do that. There's some, you know, policies you could do to try to, you know, sort of outreach to different political demographics. We could make sure that we don't, we can, you know, try to have some oversight. So make sure that we don't discriminate. I won't go into the details. I feel like, you know, right here, but you know, there are some things that we could do, and people have come up with proposals that are different from what's going on right now. Again, the idea wouldn't be to enforce right-wing ideology on the university. The idea would be to enforce open inquiry, right? That's what the government could do. And that's what I'm talking about, you know, making sure that the reason that people don't get jobs, the reason that, you know, people don't talk in the academy is not because they're being discriminated against or because they're fearing retaliation. I guess I'll just close by saying, you know, the university, it makes me think of the times in the early modern period when you were transitioning from the Catholic universities of the Middle Ages into the modern world. A lot of the intellectual action was happening outside of the universities, you know, Descartes and Bacon and the people who brought about the scientific revolution in the modern world. They weren't working at universities because their thought was kind of outside of the bounds, frankly. And so, you know, what was going on was being discussed in Parisian salons and, you know, in private institutions like the Royal Society in London. We've heard of those places and we know the thoughts of those philosophers right now, but you know, we don't remember a lot of what was going on in the Catholic universities at that time because they kind of got left behind. And, you know, one could argue that's not even for the better, but the point being that we could get left behind too. Now we could become sort of culturally irrelevant. And so by opening up the discussion, I think we gives us a chance to remain culturally relevant. I think that would be a good thing.
All right. Thank you both.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's program featured a discussion between philosophy professors John Waterman and Andrew Rotondo. It was recorded in front of an audience at the University of New England in Biddeford, Maine on April 6. You can find this episode and many other on-demand programs on our website, mainepublic.org. Click on shows to find Speaking in Maine, including this episode. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Susan Tran is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and today's program was produced by me, Jane Donahue. Thanks for joining us. This is Maine Public Radio.